This is the Tuesday Brown Bagger, where you can expect to hear great speeches from Vancouver. We do it every Tuesday at noon hour on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio. Today we take a tough look at the question, is there a fatal flaw in our culture that leads inevitably to disasters like climate change? Christopher Nowlan says there is. He is a Vancouver-based author, teacher, and criminal lawyer. Before the bar of nature, Nowlan says, we are all guilty of wanting more. It is part of the ethic of production and consumption that measures increase as the only good, whether it is the gross national product or the amount of stuff in your closets. Are we ever satisfied? What if nature can't take it anymore? Nowlan spoke at the Vancouver Public Library on April 15, 2008. It was a joint presentation by the Necessary Voices Society and Granville Island Publishing, who published Nowlan's 2007 novel, To See the Sky. What if we produce less? Why is our culture always selling us things we don't need? Let's listen to Christopher Nowlan.
So, our presenter is Christopher Nowlan. He is a writer, an artist, a teacher, and a criminal lawyer. I asked him which one he was most, and he said it depended on which day. And he kind of said they're all really the same thing as well. And so tonight he's going to talk about the intersection of culture, by which he means our habits of consumption and production, and debates on climate change. And I will leave the rest to him, Christopher Nowlan.
Okay, I'm going to stick fairly closely to this script that I've prepared. It's a habit I have from probably being an appeal lawyer, where if you don't have that script, it's only a matter of time before one of the judges in the panel decides to throw you off of it quite happily. They have a lot of fun, but I always have a hard time getting back to trying to be intelligent before the court. So it's like a security blanket for me this time. So this year is the 50th anniversary of John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society. It's an economic treatise that became a bestseller for months and was heavily influential in the politics of the day. When I recently read and reread Galbraith's book, I found it to be a compelling critique of certain values that guide the thinking and behavior of North American society. These include the priority we give in our practical lives to private gain, our reluctance to pay for public services such as education, transportation, roads, and sanitation, and our uncritical commitment to the production of material and consumer goods. Ours is a society in which those who are not enthusiastically committed to the production of goods that can be sold and bought in the marketplace are seen as slackers, wastrels, even anti-establishment. You might be surprised to learn that for Galbraith, an economy that was comfortable with slack was preferable to one premised on the importance of full production. This evening I will highlight the importance of Galbraith's The Affluent Society to contemporary discussions and debates about climate change. I will start with a statistic Michael Spector provided in a recent New Yorker article entitled Bigfoot. There he informs us that industrial activity accounts for approximately 15% of all greenhouse gases. Now that's a significant portion in my view. The same figure applies to transportation. Significantly, the bigger problem is deforestation in Indonesia and Brazil, two countries that account for approximately 10% of the world's greenhouse gases. I'll focus primarily on industrial activity and in transportation, but I'll address deforestation insofar as it is directly relevant to the biofuel industry. My thesis is simply that one way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is to reduce the amount of industrial and commercial activity in which nations engage. And my question, therefore, is why don't we do this? Why don't our leaders even countenance the thought? The answer, I think, lies in the conventional wisdom of economists that industrial growth and expansion serve the best interests of society, that increased production of material goods and the ready consumption of these goods, not marketplace modesty, are the key to creating healthy, vibrant societies. This is what I'm going to talk about tonight. For as Galbraith contends, we who live in affluent societies do not need much, if most, of what our factories produce. Our landfills are packed with the excesses of our productive and consumptive tendencies. And if we don't need much of what we produce, how do we justify the amount of unnecessary consumer goods we make, especially when the production processes send significant amounts of CO2 into the sky? As Ursula Franklin, an esteemed Canadian scientist, pointed out in 1990, the world at large has had no great difficulty with China's one child per family policy, but, she asks, and I'm quoting her now, Where in North America, Western Europe, or Japan is there serious discussion on the political level about, for instance, the need for a one car per family policy for the sake of the country's or the world's future? Now may be the time to take machine demography seriously and enter into real discussions about machine population control. End of quote. I ask the same question, but not only about machines, but about what machines produce. For Galbraith, we need to produce, industrial and otherwise, simply because we need income. Working on production lines, in whatever form these might take, provide us with income. The important questions for this environmentally sensitive age, however, like those of prior generations, are how much income do we really need? If we need a lot, why? To spend it on what? Expensive vacations, conveniences, luxuries, to pay off debt? American indebtedness is at an all-time high. So why have we become so indebted? The banks are not at fault. Mortgage rates aren't the problem. For you can always ask ourselves, why do we choose to live beyond our means? Why do we insist on buying now what we can't afford right now? Galbraith, the affluent society, presents us with an engaging paradox. Just because it recognizes that we need to work to earn income, but we don't really need most of what our work produces. We don't need electric toothbrushes, or shavers for that matter, or Porsche automobiles, Blackberries, or Lululemon yoga gear. And it takes a lot of industrial energy to make all this stuff. Arguably, if we were to shut down the plants and the factories that make these unnecessary goods, or more realistically, if we were to operate these plants and factories at less than capacity, one day less per week, for example, we would reduce the amount of air, ground, and water pollution they cause. Naturally, these factories would also employ less people. But would unemployment necessarily become a pressing concern? Would our economy grind to a halt? Galbraith doesn't think so. Implicit in his analyses are such questions as, why don't we work less and produce less? Why not reprioritize the nature of our work, from the production of consumer goods to the provision of public services? Why not be more generous with unemployment insurance? After all, affluent societies can afford to be. Galbraith acknowledges the inescapable fact that in the early decades of the 20th century, America, it was increased industrial output, not income redistribution, that improved the economic lot of most Americans. This was also the case for 19th century Industrial Revolution England. Production, not taxation, brought employment and created a lower middle class majority. The corporate owners got richer and in that sense benefited most from increased production, but significantly, a lower middle class with purchasing power swelled up. And as a result, the inequality created by North America's capitalist system slipped in its importance as a socio-political issue of the day. Increased productivity had come to the fore. It benefited corporate power and increased the paychecks of the middle class, even though it left, in Galbraith's words, a self-perpetuating margin of poverty at the very base of the income pyramid. As Galbraith saw it, increasing aggregate output was preferable to income redistribution because it posed less potential for real political confrontation. In short, it benefited to varying degrees the great majority of a society's population. So now we, as a society, believe in the importance of high production. This is part of our culture. What else can we say about our culture? Our culture, if I can use that word, is one of contentment, comfort, and convenience. It is nicely reflected in the following sentiments that Wallace Shawn expressed to his troubled friend Andre Gregory in My Dinner with Andre. Wallace says, I would never give up my electric blanket. I mean, because New York is cold in the winter. I mean, our apartment is cold. It's a difficult environment. I mean, our lives are tough enough as it is. I'm not looking for ways to get rid of the few things that provide relief and comfort. I mean, on the contrary, I'm looking for more comfort. Ours is a culture in which we are encouraged to work hard in order to make our life easier, indeed more comfortable, and to provide security for ourselves. Significantly, however, as we secure the financial means for obtaining the bare necessities and more, as we find our so-called standard of living increasing, many of us continue to look for new sources of comfort. We are never quite content enough. There is always the neighbor with a nicer car or a larger television set, or a friend acquire season's tickets to the opera or to the Canucks, though more likely the latter. There is always a new sun destination worth trying. In 1899, the American thinker Thorsten Veblen described this phenomena as follows. to quote him, "As fast as a person makes new acquisitions and becomes accustomed to the resulting new standard of wealth, the new standard forthwith ceases to afford appreciably greater satisfaction than the earlier standard did. The tendency, in any case, is constantly to make the present pecuniary standard the point of departure for a fresh increase of wealth." In a similar vein, Galbraith believed that we are subject to a dependence effect. The more goods that are produced and sold to us, the more we come to depend on those goods as sources of comfort and satisfaction in our lives. And in Galbraith's view, there is nothing especially nebulous or magical about this. Inventors, entrepreneurs, and companies create new products. But more often than not, we don't need these. Objectively speaking, that is. We don't need Starbucks burnt coffee. We never did. We didn't need the Model T, and we don't need Hummers. We never needed televisions. We think we do now. Again, we never needed cell phones or Blackberries. We think we do now. And we won't need the Virgin Group's forthcoming fleet of spaceships that will carry 6 passengers per trip beyond the Earth's atmosphere and back for $200,000 a head. We won't need these spacecrafts, but as The Economist informed us in January of this year, hundreds of people have put down a total of $30 million in deposits. And the new craft may one day do a lot more than take day trippers to the edge of space and back. It'll take other payloads like satellites. New products have to be sold to us by ad and salespeople who make them appear attractive and desirable, even necessary. And many of us buy into this. Just a few of us at first, then more and more, and eventually the product becomes commonplace, if not institutionalized. For Galbraith, the plain fact that companies habitually produce unnecessary or low-urgency goods and services and then work hard to make them seem otherwise, that is, as necessary, through advertising, is the linchpin of the dependence effect. He wrote, "Production only fills a void that it has itself created." Surely no apologies need be made for our desires to live comfortably. I'm sure the desire is universal throughout the entire animal kingdom. But our tendency toward gratuitous excess and even our acculturated aversion to inconvenience is another matter, especially for those who pretend to care about climate change. And it is here that our very culture stands as a formidable bulwark, indeed antagonist, against the scientific community that is attempting to slow down the pace at which glaciers are melting and Iceland is dissolving. Nearly 15 years before An Inconvenient Truth showed to audiences across North America, John Kenneth Galbraith wrote an entire book about the noticeable tendency among the contented majority, as he understood and defined the great majority of Americans, to resist any political plan of action that threatened to compromise their present comforts. So this was in 1992. That book was called The Culture of Contentment. Writing specifically of the acid rain problem caused by sulfurous emissions from the Midwest, he noted that the contented of America did not deny the problem, but preferred to delay corrective action. This was to be expected because in his view, to quote him, "short-run public inaction, even if held to be alarming as to consequence, is always preferred to protective long-run action," end of quote. In this 1992 book, he said this was the case even where global warming is the pressing issue. And that was in 1992, that was his expression. So let us ask, for example, how this perspective plays itself out with respect to the Northern Alberta tar sands. Don Walton wrote recently that, quote, "Albertans, it seems, are hooked on the oil sands. They love all the jobs that the pay dirt has created and the handsome quality of life it has bestowed. They say these things like any honest addict coming off a high, knowing they'll regret it later," end of quote. A survey revealed that 75% of Albertans said they have a good or excellent quality of life. 83% of Albertans said the oil sands have been a good thing for Alberta. But 60% or more of Albertans said that the oil sands extraction is hurting the planet, and about 50% of those polled said that if the current pace of development continues, there will not be enough fresh water to meet the needs of peoples and businesses in Alberta down the road. The current Alberta government is pro-development. But only a few days after Ms. Walton's article was published, Peter Lougheed, the Alberta Premier from 1971 to 1985, expressed his wish for Alberta to slow down the pace of oil sands development. After all, oil sands exploitation is expected to quadruple over the next decade. Lougheed is aware that the oil industry wishes he would stifle his opinion, And he readily acknowledged to CBC how different his perspective about oil exploitation is from the Bush administration's. But Lougheed wondered, what is the big hurry to get the oil out of the ground? It isn't going to go anywhere on of its own accord, he pointed out. Lest the Alberta government and its citizens be unfairly singled out as uniquely profit-oriented and ecologically untroubled when it comes to the tar sands, it is worth reading the following from a January Globe and Mail article. To quote it, virtually every major oil company in the Western world has picked up a piece of the action, investing nearly $90 billion to create what promises to be the biggest industrial project on Earth and sparking predictions that Canada will become what Prime Minister Stephen Harper calls an energy superpower. Indeed, in 2006, Prime Minister Harper proudly described the scale of oil sands development as, to quote him, an enterprise of epic proportions akin to the building of the pyramids or China's Great Wall, only bigger, end of quote. With relish, he said, to quote him, an ocean of oil-soaked sand lies under the muskeg of northern Alberta, my home province, end of quote. It's my province as well, my home province. According to Andrew Nikiforuk, economists calculate that the oil sands will contribute nearly $1 trillion to Canada's gross domestic product by 2020. Not surprisingly, we learned from Nikiforuk that, to quote him, planned expansions could bring the total, end of quote, barrels of fresh water that oil sands are allowed to use a year to 4.2 billion. This is an amount that Natural Resources Canada says is unsustainable because the Athabasca River does not have sufficient flows. Bearing Galbraith in mind, we might simply ask, what is more important, for Canada to become an energy superpower, to exploit natural resources to epic proportions, or to show conservationist stewardship at a time when doing so appears more advisable? This is a question of culture, in my view, because the desire of a man, a community, or a nation to be super at anything, to have a greater GDP than one's neighbors, for example, has its roots in a psychological, irrational place, not in the world of supply and demand curves. Recently, the Globe and Mail reported that oil sands production alone is expected to create 25% of Canada's CO2 emissions by 2020, up from the current level of about 18%. Of course, the federal government's plan is to find ways to minimize greenhouse gas emissions per barrel of oil produced from the sands, but not to decrease the number of barrels of oil produced. This policy is consistent with Galbraith's view that the dominant mindset of North American economists is to produce at full capacity at almost any cost. It is also consistent with my thesis this evening that we prefer to maintain a production status quo, or even better, through technological innovation, rather than to reduce unnecessary production and consumption. We look to science, not to the way we live, for solutions. Let us look at another example of dangerous industrial overproduction driven by the importance of maintaining our culture of contentment, namely the boom in the biofuels market. Upon reading Michael Grunwald's recent article in Time magazine called The Clean Energy Scam, we learn that the southern Amazon rainforest and the forests of Brazil and Malaysia are being toppled on a massive scale to make room for soybeans and palm oil tree farms. These plants are in turn used to produce biofuels that are actually net carbon emitters and which only slightly reduce America's dependence on foreign oil. We learn that if 100% of America's production of corn and soybean were turned into fuel, it would be enough to offset just 20% of on-road fuel consumption. But note the scale and economic logic of this destructive transformation. And I quote now the article. Biofuels have become the vanguard of the green tech revolution, the trendy way for politicians and corporations to show they're serious about finding alternative sources of energy and in the process slowing global warming. The U.S. quintupled its production of ethanol in the past decade, and Washington has just mandated another five-fold increase in renewable fuels over the next decade. Worldwide investment in biofuels rose from $5 billion in 1995 to $38 billion in 2005, and is expected to top $100 billion by 2010, thanks to investors like Richard Branson and George Soros, GE and BP, Ford and Shell, Cargill and the Cargill Group. End of quote. Now, this is on the same level of investment as the Alberta oil sands. Far from reducing CO2 emission problem, this biofuel industry is greatly exacerbating it because so much forest, wetlands, and grassland is cleared or raised to plant the crops required for the biofuels. Now, this isn't the case with sugarcane. It's an exception. A new study in Science magazine concluded that when this deforestation effect is taken into account, corn ethanol and soy biodiesel produce about twice the emissions of gasoline. But now, as Grunewald observes, to quote, backed by billions in investment capital, this alarming phenomena is replicating itself around the world. It's the remorseless economics of commodity markets, end of quotes. He quotes John Carter, director of the conservationist Alianca Datara, as saying, quote, you can't protect it, referring to the Brazilian rainforest. There's too much money to be made in tearing it down, end of quotes. And that was a reference to for biofuels. Now, as Galbraith saw it at the mid-20th century, production was viewed politically and economically as the central achievement of American society. He wrote, to quote him, on the importance of production, there is no difference between Republicans and Democrats, right and left, white or colored, Catholic or Protestant. It is common ground for the General Secretary of the Communist Party, the Chairman of Americans for Democratic Action, the President of the United States Chamber of Commerce, and the President of the National Association of Manufacturers, end of quote. This is because production is the bedrock or the anchor of the economist's calculation. In doubting its supreme power, Galbraith claimed, to quote him, we are challenging a phenomena that is still of heroic proportions, end of quote. And the importance we attribute to production is buttressed, he wrote, to quote him, by a highly dubious but widely accepted psychology of want, by an equally dubious but equally accepted interpretation of national interest, and by powerful vested interest. So all-embracing indeed is our sense of importance of production as a goal that the first reaction to any questioning in this attitude will be, what else is there? End of quote. Following the climate talks in Bali in December of 2007, the White House emphasized that any successor treaty to Kyoto must acknowledge a nation's sovereign right to pursue economic growth. This stance should not seem surprising. Galbraith reminds us that, quote, a society which sets as its highest goal the production of private consumer goods will continue to reflect such attitudes in all its public decisions, end of quote. For Galbraith, the conventional economic wisdom, and he coined that expression, by the way, the conventional wisdom, exaggerates the importance of production to economic security in an affluent society. He wrote, to quote him, so compulsive, indeed, is the pressure to maintain output as a requisite of economic security that the economy is impelled to a level of performance which, as things now stand, it can sustain only with difficulty and at some cost and danger. End of quote. And remember, this is in 1958. This is entirely consistent with what Peter Lougheed is trying to say about the Alberta oil sands and with what John Carter is trying to say about the Brazilian rainforest. Little regard is paid to the real danger of serious water shortages caused by excessive oil extraction from the tar sands. Little regard is being paid to the deforestation of precious rainforests in the name of producing biofuels. Conrad Schmidt, and I'm going to plug his book here for a moment, I think there's only one copy over there, observes in his recent book, Workers of the World Relax, and to quote him, we are able to recognize that the current system of infinitely trying to grow the economy is not only hurting the planet, but weakening our society. Despite the clarity and urgency of the situation, most of our leaders are afraid that an economic slowdown will result in us losing our competitive edge in international trade, end of quotes. Indeed, our culture is one which regards economic expansion and aggrandizement as the only viable course for a healthy society. Galbraith believed that we cling to productivity as the measure of societal well-being, even though we actually sense the declining importance of goods. Because this is so much simpler than to substitute new tests for happiness, such as compassion, individual health, and the minimization of community tensions. In other words, culture is at the heart of the problem. William Hanley, a columnist for the National Post, recently alluded to this peculiarity of American culture when he wrote, to quote him, right now, Americans are squandering their children's and grandchildren's legacies on, among other things, the war in Iraq, flat-screen high-def TVs, and gas-guzzling SUVs, while financing the ambitions of China and other lenders, end of quote. Though Hanley was writing about retirement planning, of all things, his piece emphasized the anti-conservationist ethos of American economic policy right now, a point to which I'll return a bit later. Galbraith likened the dominant model upon which our economies function as a squirrel wheel, in which the squirrel tries harder and harder to keep abreast of the wheel that it is itself propelling. The squirrel is the eternally busy producer in an affluent society, whose efforts spawn consumer desires that are perpetually changing in direct relation to the new products that the producer makes. Galbraith wrote, to quote him, "Among the many models of the good society, no one has urged the squirrel wheel. Aside from its dubious cultural charm, there are serious structural weaknesses which may one day embarrass us." End of quote. I believe that if the anthropocentric view of climate change is correct, our day of embarrassment has come. We are told these days to conserve energy, to use less gas and less electricity. But this message is starkly at odds with our society's push to produce and with the pressure we feel to produce as much, if not more, than our co-workers and our competitors. Our factories and plants could shut down early in the day or one less day a week to conserve hydro or natural gas or to pollute less, but this is not likely to happen. On the contrary, we can expect factory owners to implement ecologically friendly technical innovations to phase out the use of dirty oil, for example, in favor of clean oil, but the retooled factories will still strive to make greater profits and therefore to produce and sell more widgets. The result will not likely be environmentally beneficial. Certainly governments brag about producing less of whatever is considered widely to be detrimental to society, such as CO2 emissions, pollution, and crime. But political leaders and economic advisors in the West do not yet view the surplus goods themselves, last year's cars, computers, and televisions that didn't sell, or all the excess food that goes to rot, as being environmentally deleterious as the pollution caused by making it. They see the production of low or marginal utility goods as economic goods, not as bads, in other words, as contributing to the liveliness of private enterprise, and they would rather increase employment in industries that yield more and more junk than find ways of employing people in the public services, for example. In 1958, Galbraith did not provide a definition for an affluent society, though he was clearly writing about America at the time. He observed that more died in that country of, to quote him, "of too much food than of too little," end of quote. And yet, he observed, the food supply pressed relentlessly upon the population. In my view, this is an apt measure of an affluent society. Today, increased output in America and Canada is not necessary to put food on the tables of the majority of citizens, nor is it necessary to improve the lot of the poorest citizens of these countries. Rather, it satisfies many of our cravings for the luxuries of life, more elegant automobiles, more exotic food, more elaborate entertainment, etc., what Galbraith calls the entire range of sensuous, edifying, and lethal desires. But now we live in a time when broad public awareness, maybe just perception or belief, about our role in climate change invites us to check our desires to consume many of the goods and services that are produced solely for our recreation, relaxation, and even edification, to use Galbraith's term. I was surprised to learn, for example, that according to a recent study, 18 million barrels of oil are burned and 41 billion gallons of fresh water consumed every day by factories across the world just to make bottled water for American consumption. Certainly most of us don't need bottled water, but the global industry in bottled water is $50 billion U.S. And consider our propensity for travel, whether it be purely recreational, business-oriented, or adventure-based. The Toronto-based GAP, I'm going to call them GAP, Adventures Tours Package offers, in the words of one writer, an adventure cruise to Antarctica in which takers, quote, get a chance to experience an otherworldly landscape of translucent icebergs, penguin rookies, end of quote, and more. Now, as Mr. Bridge, the writer, describes it, quote, "Some passengers come for the scenery and wildlife. Some are drawn to Antarctica by the tales of obsessive explorers like Shackleton, Amundsen, and Cherry Garrard. And a few haul their duffels up to the explorer's gangplank as continent baggers, pen in hand, ready to scratch the Earth's seventh landmass off their list." End of quote.
You are tuned to the Tuesday Brown Bagger program on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. We are listening in to a carefully reasoned argument by Vancouver author and lawyer Christopher Nowlan. This speech was recorded by Alex Smith on April 15, 2008.
Apparently continent baggers, like some or many of us these days, have become environmentally conscious. So we would expect the Gap Adventure Package to offer its consumers nothing less than some assurance that their hard-earned fare is not contributing to ecological spoil. Mr. Bridge unabashedly declares, to quote him again, "Responsible tourism in the 21st century means taking responsibility for carbon emissions, and Gap Adventures is ahead of the curve, offering carbon offsets via Sustainable Travel International. For the 5.5 tons of carbon dioxide emissions I created by flying from Vancouver, BC to Tierra del Fuego, offsets paid to solar power generation projects in Africa, among other projects, cost about $100. Good news for sustainable tourism and for penguins." End of quote. I might not have found a better article than one happily entitled "The Last Place on Earth," about affluent tourists who take a well-heated cruise ship to observe dwindling spectacles of nature to make a point about the impact of human luxuriating on the environment. But then I learned about the private Starship Enterprise race to space headed by Sir Richard Branson and others. This will be seen as quite timely by those who managed to bag every continent on Earth and still have money burning in their pockets to see what damage human beings have done to the entire planet. I'll address this human drive to jet into the cosmos shortly, but first I'll return to Galbraith, point out what he considers to be serious problems associated with a society that extols the virtues of production at almost any cost. There's at least three of these: the creation of consumer debt, inflation, and the prioritization of privately produced goods over publicly provided goods and services. Each of these has implications for our current environmental predicament. With respect to the creation of consumer debt, Galbraith writes, to quote, "It would be surprising indeed if a society that is prepared to spend thousands of millions to persuade people of their wants were to fail to take further step of financing these wants, and were it not then to go on to persuade people of the ease and desirability of incurring debt to make these wants effective. This has happened. The process of persuading people to incur debt and the arrangement for them to do so are as much a part of the modern production as the making of the goods and the nurturing of the wants." End of quote. In the affluent society, Galbraith traced the growth of consumer debt in America from the 1920s through the early 50s. And he observed that about 30% of Americans who had bought their cars, their first cars on a credit card, had bought their previous car the same way and still had outstanding debt on the same vehicle. So he wrote, quote, "One wonders inevitably about the tensions associated with debt creation on such a massive scale." End of quote. And he asks, quote, can the bill collector be the central figure in the good society? End of quote. He or she certainly has become so, the bill collector, that is, if we consider the ethos of rampant production and consumption in America, not conservation, to be reflective of the good society. The American economy is currently suffering the deleterious effects of a society so thoroughly steeped in a culture of indebtedness, however, that the bill collector there has become an ineffectual scarecrow. So many Americans have become unable to pay their creditors and lenders that the problem has had a broad societal ripple effect, and the government has had to come to the rescue. Not surprisingly, the solution has been for the government to indebt itself further by giving money to the banks, by lowering interest rates, and by sending out checks to individuals, families, and businesses in the form of tax rebates. This is not surprising, I say, because North American culture is one in which we are encouraged to live beyond our means. The rebate that Americans will receive will give them the means to buy consumer goods, in some cases the bare necessities, but it certainly doesn't come with a government missive attached. In other words, it says, be frugal, conserve, spend this money wisely. The government is not a money tree. By the same token, our political leaders do not look to our dwindling natural resources, North American forests, rivers, and oil sands, and say, let's be careful here, let's conserve or preserve this stuff. On the contrary, the goal is to exploit these resources for short-term consumption, for private profit, and to maintain our behavioral status quo. The Bush administration's response to the so-called subprime mortgage crisis has been to stimulate the economy as fast as possible by providing the majority of Americans with spending money. President Bush announced proudly upon the January 24th announcement of his $150 billion salvo, quote, "This package will lead to higher consumer spending and increased business investment," end of quote. Those who are used to earning decent incomes, up to $75,000 gross a year, but who spend beyond their means, will get the rebate. So will couples who have grossed up to $150,000. The ethos of the American Rescue attempt has been anything but conservationist. William Hanley wrote, quote, "The U.S. Federal Reserve, charged with maintaining financial stability and defending the value of the currency, is providing citizens with great cheap money incentives to unsave their hard-earned dollars, which are rapidly losing value in world markets. Please borrow and spend as much as you can." End of quote. One gets a telling glimpse of some of the behavior that has led the U.S. into the subprime crisis from a recent New York Times article entitled, "This is the Sound of the Bubble Bursting." This article presents a stark picture of inflation and its tendency to appeal to a get-rich-quick mentality. A real estate broker in Cape Coral candidly noted that, quote, "Greed and speculation created the monster," end of quote. The article's author, Peter Goodman, observed that, quote, "Creative financing lubricated the developing boom, making it easier for buyers to take on more mortgage debt than they could otherwise handle, driving prices skyward. Each upward burst brought more investors," end of quote. Another analyst, Eric Jansen, noted that demand for homes skyrocketed when adjustable rate mortgage rates were drastically lowered, as potential buyers could now get a monthly mortgage rate for a $500,000 home, the same rate as that for a $250,000 home purchased 2 years earlier. In Goodman's article, we learn of a fellow who owned rental property in Ohio and who, upon seeing the situation in Cape Coral, Florida, put down $10,000 on three lots. As soon as the homes were built on these lots, he flipped them for about $175,000 each and bought more lots. Then he became a real estate agent and opened a company which eventually employed 40 agents. At the height of the Florida boom, in 2005, he'd made $800,000 and told the reporter that, quote, "pretty much anybody could become an overnight millionaire," end of quote. Then the inflation hit hard, growth exceeded demand, and people started dumping property. This fellow ended up closing his company and moving to Atlanta. A married couple, the Pellegrinos, bought a three-bedroom home for $97,000 without having to make a down payment. As property values soared, they received many offers to convert the worth of their home into cash by refinancing their mortgage, and they did. They borrowed against, quote, the inflated value of their home to buy two businesses, an auto repair shop and a lawn service, end of quote. Then the husband died, leaving his 53-year-old wife with the two businesses in debt and with the $207,000 she owed against her home, now worth $130,000. She figured she had about 6 months before her home would be foreclosed. A third casualty was a mental health counselor from Illinois who arrived in Florida in 1995, put down $1,000 to buy a house in Lehigh Acres, and began selling real estate. Over time, he bought, quote, "progressively nicer homes, keeping the older ones to rent, while borrowing against the rising value of one to finance the next," end of quote. Eventually, he acquired a taste for expensive dinners, a convertible Corvette, and a powerboat. But at the time of Goodman's article, he was on a downward spiral, not having sold a home in 3 months, having fallen behind on his own mortgage payments, having dropped life insurance for his family, having started to sell a nutritional juice to supplement his dwindled income, and having applied for a state-subsidized health plans. His plans were to sell everything, move into a rental property, and start all over. This is our culture, too, one which encourages spending and producing beyond our means. It is one in which inflation is normal and indebtedness is institutionalized. A recent piece in the Globe and Mail, entitled "As Main Street Splurges," tells of an Alberta couple who have borrowed steadily to accumulate Alberta real estate. At 42 years of age, they own two RV lots, an 80-acre farm, and they just borrowed $100,000 to buy a $165,000 U.S. retirement home in Phoenix, significantly adding to their family debt load. That's them telling the reporter that. A chart attached to the article entitled "Keep on Spending" indicates that, quote, "consumer borrowing is rising as mortgages and lines of credit soar," end of quote. This is Canada. The condominium boom in Vancouver says much about the moral priority our society gives to material acquisition and private profit over conservation. There are those, for sure, who might see the rise of the condominium market as a welcome and viable opportunity for apartment renters to break free from subservience to their landlords and to acquire a home of their own. For whatever reason, home ownership, as opposed to residential tenancy, appears to be a cultural ideal in North America. But condominium sales have not skyrocketed in Vancouver and elsewhere because they provide struggling couples independence and maybe a tiny plot of earth to call their own, to cultivate as they wish. Some purchasers have had to incur serious mortgage commitments to reside in these minuscule residences. These people find themselves overworked, stressed, and overextended, hardly independent, and indeed subservient to their lenders, being banks. In regard to the similar situation in the U.S., Michael Hudson writes, quote, "The trap is a modern equivalent to peonage," end of quote, to serfdom. Of course, some purchasers see condos as smart, long-term investments. For others, they are simply intended to be flipped at the most opportune, i.e. profitable time. Hudson observes that, quote, "In recent years in the U.S., the biggest incentive to home ownership has not been owning a home per se or even avoiding taxes, but rather the eternal hope of getting ahead," end of quotes. The Vancouver condominium boom is especially significant in terms of what I am trying to say here about culture and ecology, just because the average square footage of a condominium is much less than that of a detached single home. On average, condo buyers are actually buying modest living spaces. In this sense alone, they are making a more environmentally friendly consumer decision than those who buy bigger detached homes, all things being equal. However, if we look at this picture from a cultural perspective, we must note that the comparatively small size of condos is hardly their selling feature. It is perhaps the most embarrassing feature of the home, that is, that it's so small for such a large price. The opening line of an article called Boom or Bust from January of this year reads, "Let it be known, Christy Collin is not in the market for a shoebox," end of quote. Indeed, many prospective condo unit purchasers would prefer to get more floor space for less. They are attracted to the condominium market because it represents home ownership and an offer of an attractive lifestyle. The smallness of the unit simply serves the interests of the developer, who can sell more units per square foot of the overall building space. So here we are en masse, overspending and living beyond our means, relying upon institutionalized credit systems to get by, and this is entirely acceptable. This is entirely acceptable. Indeed, it is encouraged by the system itself. Galbraith points out that, to quote him, "As we expand debt in the process of want creation, we come necessarily to depend on this expansion," end of quote. And this elaborate dependence effect is reflected in many ways in our relationship to our natural environment. As we run out of oil because we have wasted it in colossal proportions on getting us from point A to point B for business, leisure, and frivolity with great comfort and convenience, and with the same kind of speed by which we expect to be fed at McDonald's, the depth of our indebtedness to nature, our great lender, has become starkly manifest. We desperately mine the Alberta tar sands, utilizing billions of gallons of water in the process. We build hydroelectric plants wherever possible along BC's rivers, and we scramble to get pole position in the Arctic so that when global warming opens it up enough for drilling purposes, we can start pumping our rightful share of an estimated 175 billion barrels of oil from its frigid depths, all to preserve our preferred way of life, all to keep Mother Nature's unflinching bill collector from arriving at our door. George Newton, the ex-chairman of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, referred to Canada's Arctic archipelago as the next oil elephant, and he said, to quote him as an American, "Our need for oil is not going to go away. We're going to need every bit we can get our hands on. Even if we don't use as much in cars and trucks, we're going to need plastics and fertilizers and all these other things essential to daily life. The more oil that's tied to us directly, the more that comes in a pipeline or in a short trip in U.S. waters, the better off we are," end of quote. We just don't get it. Ronald Wright observed, and this is from his book, A Short History of Progress, he observed of the fall of the third dynasty of Ur in southern Iraq, this would be in the second millennium, to quote him, "The short-lived empire of Ur exhibits the same behavior as we saw in Easter Island, sticking to entrenched beliefs and practices, robbing the future to pay the present, spending the last reserves of natural capital on a reckless binge of excessive wealth and glory, end of quote. Despite such glimpses of the consequences of the great bill collector's arrival, we still don't think about scaling back. Let us not lose sight of the fact that, in our consumerist culture, it is credit card companies themselves who actively solicit our participation in carbon offset schemes to assuage our guilt for purchasing unnecessary consumer goods or for buying beyond our present capability. Last December, the Vancouver Sun carried an article entitled Going Green Pays Off as More Companies Offer Environmental Reward Points. Its author, Misty Harris, opened it as follows, quote, "While you still can't buy your way into heaven, you can redeem your environmental sins for just a few thousand reward points," end of quotes. The article informs us that shoppers at popular retail such as Zellers, The Bay, and Home Outfitters can donate their shopping reward points, points that have encouraged shopping, of course, to environmental initiatives with which the stores are registered. By using the Ecologic MasterCard, for example, consumers earn points that MBNA Canada will use to purchase carbon offset credits that support environmental projects. This is the same message promoted in the Last Place on Earth article about the Gap Adventures. Go ahead, spend more on products that you don't need and can't afford, and in so doing, contribute needlessly to the pollution created by the manufacture of products, but feel good about it, because a nominal percentage of the cost of your purchase will go to buying carbon offset credits. We are discouraged from conserving our earnings, just as we are discouraged from conserving resources out of a fear of bringing the economy into stagnation. We cannot bear to think that the tar sands or the floor of the Northwest Passage might just sit untouched by capital investment. The notion of savings and reservoirs does not sit easily with those who believe that a healthy society requires full production and lively commerce. So what about the prospect of conserving energy? Our energy, that is. Why not jump off Galbraith's squirrel wheel more often than we do? Why not slow down? Alarm clocks kill dreams, such as the slogan of Vancouver's Work Less Party, which could understandably, and I say this in the fondest light, be mistaken as the Work Less and Party. But the concept of working less and producing less as a matter of viable economic policy is neither idiosyncratic nor fanciful. In mid-19th century France, the peasants and farmers retired from work at the end of the summer and spent the rest of the year smoking, playing cards, hunting, and sleeping. That's one long vacation. Money was not needed by most of these people. They had to buy salt and iron, but otherwise they managed by exchanging their goods and services. Economic activity was undertaken mainly to pass time, not to make money. So one of the few activities that these farmers engaged in was clockmaking, because tinkering with tiny mechanisms made time pass less slowly. By contrast, in 1850s America, workers labored just under 70 hours per week. In 1914, however, Henry Ford reduced the 6 or 7 day work week at his automobile plants to 5 days and 8 hours per day, as opposed to the usual 10 hours. It was his firm belief that if working citizens were given more leisure time, they would consume more and indeed travel more, therefore increasing the need for more transportation facilities and, of course, automobiles. Presumably, therefore, increased leisure time would bring greater profits to the Ford Motor Company. By 1950, Americans worked 40 hours per week, and in 1956, Richard Nixon, of all people, actually promised Americans a 4-day, 32-hour work week in his presidential campaign. This promise did not materialize, and I don't know why. In 2000, let's go over to France, the French government actually mandated a 35-hour work week for its citizens. Now, the rationale for this policy was to distribute available work more evenly, that is, to curb unemployment and to allow workers to spend more time with their families. Unfortunately for the French, this policy had a short shelf life. In October 2007, Sarkozy decried his country's 35-hour work week policy by suggesting that it was, his words, madness to, quote, think that the way to increase wealth and create jobs is to work less, big exclamation mark, end of quote. His campaign slogan was, work more to earn more. And when he became president, he removed financial penalties for those who had employees work more than 35 hours per week. His decision sparked domestic protests and strikes. For Galbraith, a system of morality is at stake here. When food was scarce, labor to produce it was valuable, as it provided sustenance for the greater good of the community. But today, in industrialized worlds, the production of goods have ceased to be urgent in his view. So he asked, what immorality is there in not laboring to produce useless goods? To quote him, the idle man may still be an enemy of himself, but it is hard to say that the loss of his effort is damaging to society. End of quote. Galbraith believes that the government of an affluent society can set up a, quote, reasonably satisfactory substitute for production as a source of income, end of quote, such as unemployment compensation. But this needs to be viewed in a social context in which production is not the paramount value. For then, as Galbraith notes, we could view an increase in voluntary idleness with some equanimity. The stigma attached to unemployment has to be removed. I might say the same thing about sleeping in. Okay, Europe, but not France, lags behind the USA in terms of GDP per capita. This is mainly because employed citizens of European countries work less hours per week than Americans do, and workers in almost every developed country work fewer hours per year than those in America. Americans are also highly productive for every hour they work. According to one set of statistics, they create the fourth highest level of GDP per work hour out of 23 countries that were surveyed. Canada is 16th from the top of that list. Two analysts, David Rosnick and Mark Weisbrot, estimate that energy consumption increases per work hour as work hours increase. They believe that if Americans traded work for leisure, to quote them, Americans could reduce their energy needs by 9 to 26%, and this is based on some studies they look at. They propose that, to quote these authors, if Americans chose to take advantage of their high level of productivity by shortening the work week or taking longer vacations rather than producing more, there would follow a number of benefits, such as employed workers would find themselves with 7 additional weeks off, and the United States would consume some 20% less energy. End of quote. I'm not so sure. We have to ask ourselves, what do Americans and Canadians do with their leisure time? One of the more obvious answers here is we fly away or we pull cars from huge trailers along highways. Not all of us, of course. Some of us, we've all seen it. Some of us go camping. In any case, we're inclined to get away. In this sense, culture is critical. For Henry Ford, remember, a reduced work week meant more automobile transportation and greater profits for his company. And in China, so-called golden holidays or golden weeks as holidays have led to dramatic levels of domestic tourism and material consumption, and also to increased profits for vendors. Of course, let's not forget there are other ways to enjoy free time. The 19th French farmer smoked, played cards, hunted, and tinkered with clocks. If energy consumption is to be reduced in a hypothetical world where citizens are provided more leisure time, we're going to have to alter our leisurely behavior. Air travel is increasing, not decreasing. Transatlantic routes have just opened up to all airlines. And Gap Adventures will happily take us to the Antarctica so we can check off that melting continent on our list before it's too late. For those of us with sufficient funds, we have come to take for granted the ability to fly anywhere. And now Sir Richard Branson will even take us into space. I'll go further, and I'll say along with Galbraith, that we have become dependent on tourism as a manner of relaxing, of unwinding, of occupying ourselves when we are not on the assembly line. We have become so accustomed to flying away for work and leisure, to pulling trailers across highways, or to taking ferries up and down coastlines, that the mid-19th century image of the French farmer sitting around a table playing cards or tinkering with clocks seems antiquated and impoverished. And with this image in mind, I would like to conclude on a psychological note about our desire to fly. In my view, the challenge of reducing CO2 emissions that lies ahead is greater than that of overcoming Galbraith's dependence effect. That difficulty is very daunting, but not insurmountable. The more difficult challenge, as I see it, is to understand and to curb our desire to fly. To appreciate the difficulty of the challenge here, try to form a picture of humankind that has no urge to fly, not just in airplanes, but in general. Imagine looking up at an eagle or a hawk or even a sparrow swooping along. Now imagine that you don't think to yourself, what a graceful animal, so light, so strong, so speedy, so observant, and seemingly free. I'm inclined to believe that we have all at one time or another wished that we could fly, just like a bird, that we could unchain ourselves from the force of gravity and escape the pressures of social living. The Wright brothers' airplanes are just one outcome of this. I want to make a reference to this desire that's reflected in the myth of Icarus and the Superman hero comic strip. These myths and stories, classical and pop culture alike, are simply the products of our fantasies, of our deep longings and fears. We desire very strongly to have the physical powers of animals, which in one sense are superhuman. We wish we could run like cheetahs, swim like dolphins, rappel like spiders, jump like elk, and fly like hawks. We understand the physical powers of these animals, and wherever possible, we try to replicate them, acquire them, or imitate them. So how is this psychology relevant to ecology? The deep human desire to fly is a reminder that some or many of us are restless as human beings, that is, and as social human beings. Our desire to fly like birds reflects the profound wish of man to be more than human and to have a greater role in nature's great ecological play. The extent of commercial air travel today is but one sign of the lengths mankind has gone to play that greater role, to be both man and bird. Sir Richard Branson's desire to get private commercial airplanes into space is an attempt to even further the importance of our role in this play, to demonstrate that we are not limited, we are not small, we are not weak. As a result of this very attitude, we get unremitting exploitation of our natural world. There are many forms this take, biotechnology being an obvious one. But when the stark messages of our folly are delivered to us, either in the form of stories, such as Icarus, or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or in real life, as Robert Wright's A Short History of Progress reveals, we turn a deaf ear. Before one gets too optimistic about the potential for North Americans to change their priorities and their values, to become modest in regard to production and consumption, we need to understand what makes human beings desire so strongly to be a bigger part of nature than we actually are. We may not be able to quell the desire to fly like birds. Our envy may simply be too great. But surely, for all the fuss we make about the size of our brains in comparison to those of birds, we can foresee the importance of self-restraint, or can't we?
That was author and lawyer Christopher Nowlin, spelled N-O-W-L-I-N. His speech on April 15, 2008, was presented by the Necessary Voices Society and Granville Island Publishing, who published his novel in 2007, To See the Sky. This was recorded by Alex Smith for CFRO Brown Bagger Program. Thanks for listening. We'll finish up with John Mayer from his Continuum album, Waiting for the World to Change.